Okay, everyone, thank you very much for coming. I want to begin by thanking Sarah and the Collège d'Etudes Mondiales for arranging this. And special thanks to Françoise, not only for the invitation, but because she invented the idea on which this is based, the slave in the Louvre, an invisible humanity. Now, it is a tremendously special honor for me to be here in front of this great painting, because I remember vividly the time 37 years ago when I first came to this great museum. And when I got here, I came immediately to this painting. This was the first thing I wanted to see. And I stood in front of this painting for a very long time, just full of awe, full of wonder. Now, what I saw 37 years ago was what I think most everyone sees when they look at this painting. They see the perfect romantic expression of the struggle of man against nature. The sea had always interested the romantics, the poets, Samuel Coleridge. They were all interested in the sea because it was powerful, it was terrifying, it was beautiful, it was sublime. Now, since I came here 37 years ago, what I have devoted my life to doing is studying people just like the ones you see on this raft. I study sailors. I study poor working people. I study those who were the laborers who made the Medusa sail. The history that I do is called history from below, meaning the history of ordinary people. Not the admirals and the captains, but the ordinary folks. So I want to suggest to you that I have learned in recent years something about how to imagine this painting from the point of view of the people on the raft. That's the point of departure. Now, I must say, I must tell you, I am not a French historian. I am not a historian of art. I am certainly not a Géricault specialist. I am a social historian and a maritime historian, but I do think that perspective can help us to see some hidden themes in this painting, especially on the issues of race, class, slavery, and colonialism. All of these things were on Géricault's mind as he painted this great painting. Okay, so I'm a historian. For a historian, context is everything. So the meaning of this painting derives from the context of what happened in the years 1814 and 1815. As you know, the Napoleonic Wars came to an end. France was defeated. The Peace of Paris in 1814 and the Congress of Vienna in 1814 and 1815 helped to restore the Bourbon monarchy, as I'm sure all of you know. What you may not know is that in 1815, France also abolished the slave trade. Okay, that is going to play a very important part in this story. Because of the abolition of the slave trade, Britain, at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, was willing to give back to France the colony of Senegal in West Africa. This colony had gone back and forth between the British and the French for about 50 years. So, a ship called the Medusa prepares and leaves from Rochefort to go to Senegal to repossess that colony for the French crown. That's where the Medusa was going. Okay? Very important that this be understood. This is a painting about French colonialism, fundamentally. Now, in order to make this voyage, the crown appointed a captain, a royalist, a man who will play a very important role in what happens. This man's name is Dubois du Chameray. Also on board the Medusa was the new governor of Senegal, another important player in this drama. The two of them, with a lot of settlers, board the ship. It's a very big ship, by the way. And on board the ship are mostly soldiers and sailors. Mostly soldiers and sailors. Now, Olivier, very important to know who these soldiers and sailors were. They were French. They were Spanish. They were Italian. They were Egyptian. They were African. There were quite a number of African soldiers and sailors. This is going to be very crucial. So finally, they take off from Rochefort, bound for Senegal. That's the voyage. Immediately, it becomes clear that the captain is incompetent. The captain loses the other three vessels who were part of the convoy. The captain gets off course. The captain is not only incompetent, he will not listen to his crew. He will not listen to his officers, who are telling him that they are getting into a very dangerous situation. He doesn't listen. And eventually, on July 2nd, 1816, the captain runs the ship ashore on the bank of Argan, which is about 60 kilometers off the coast of West Africa, present-day Mauritania. The vessel comes to a sudden and shocking halt. There is a furious effort to refloat the ship and get it back to sea. All of the soldiers and sailors are deployed. Everybody is doing everything they can, but there was a very unfortunate circumstance. The vessel was run ashore at high tide, which means the water would not get higher and help them to float it out. The vessel was stuck. It now becomes clear that there has to be a rescue operation. So the captain tells the members of the crew to build a raft. Now, there are on board the Medusa six small boats. That should be enough to carry everyone to safety, but this ship was overcrowded with settlers as well as soldiers. So that wasn't going to work. They weren't going to be able to get everyone on board those six vessels. There was a special barge for the captain, another barge for the governor, Governor Schmaltz of Senegal. They are all perfectly safe. And on July 5th, 3 days after the wreck, the weather turns very bad. There's a very strong gale of wind, and the belief is that the ship is going to break up. The ship is going to be destroyed. So there is a panicked movement toward the boats to try to save everyone, as many people as possible. Now, the raft has been constructed by this time. It's a big raft. It's about 7 meters wide and about 20 meters long. It's actually bigger than what Géricault painted. It's bigger. 250 of the 400 people get on board those boats to be saved, and the idea is that the remaining people, 146 men and one woman, will all go on the raft. And the plan is that there are cables attached between the other vessels and the raft, and those vessels will pull the raft those 60 kilometers to safety. Okay? But immediately there are problems. As soon as the 147 people go on board the raft and take on board casks of food and water, the casks the likes of which you see there that a man is standing on, they take those on the raft, they bring everybody on board, and immediately the raft sinks under the water and everybody is standing to hear water up to their waists. So they have to start throwing food and water overboard. Okay? Now, you should also know the raft has no oars. The raft has no proper mast and sail. This is actually a little thing that was rigged up later, but the point is the raft cannot move itself. Okay? There is no instrument of navigation on board, and the naval officer who was assigned to be the leader on the raft decides that it's too dangerous and he refuses to go aboard. So these 150 people are left in a truly desperate situation. They begin, and they are being pulled across the water toward the coast, and everybody hopes to safety. There's a lot of chaos. But then comes a crucial moment when someone, we don't know exactly who, gives the order to cut the cables. It may have been the captain, it may have been the governor, Governor Schmaltz. Many people think it was the governor who gave this. Now, why did he do that? I think there were two reasons. One, the raft was very heavy and was slowing down the escape for people on board the other vessel. They thought that they would drown in bad weather. But I think even more important was the fact that the governor and the captain were afraid that the 150 people would pull themselves up close to their boat, come on board, and capsize the whole thing. So they cut the rope. The raft is all on it. Everyone is all on their own. And truly terrible things begin to happen. There's very little food. So people start fighting over the food, with the result that the small amount of food that they have, some of it is lost overboard. Other people are literally washed off the raft by waves. They're thrown overboard and they can't recover, they can't swim. The first night that they are on their own in the raft, when the day breaks, one of the horrible things that the survivors see is that some people have gotten their bodies caught up in the rope that is meant to hold the raft together, so they have drowned. And this is only the beginning of their problems. This is only the beginning. Now, feeling truly hopeless, people begin to commit suicide. Several people just push away from the raft into the open water to die. There is on the raft starvation. There is delirium and madness. There is human sacrifice. Some of the weak and the sick are thrown overboard so that the strong can have the food and drink that they would have consumed. And of course, there is famously cannibalism on board the raft. After 13 long days and nights, the raft is discovered by a ship called the Argus, which was one of the companion ships in the original voyage, and the Argus discovered the raft by accident, by sheer accident. By that time, there were only 15 people living. 132 people had died. Now, you'll notice what Jericho has done in the painting. There are 20 people on board the raft, but five of them appear to be dead. so he's literally accurate. There were 15 survivors, but then after people are taken ashore in the effort to nurse them back to health, five more died. There are, out of the 147 original people, only 10 survivors. Okay, now, the word of this begins to get back to Paris. It is an unbelievable scandal. The big question is, the captain and the governor have been criminal in their behavior and have been charged with extreme dishonor. Dishonor of France, dishonor of their position. Now, in November 1817, two men who were survivors on this raft wrote a short book called A Narrative of the Voyage to Senegal and told all of the details about what the horrors that happened on board this raft. This becomes an even greater scandal. Newly restored King Louis XVIII is embarrassed. And people, the liberal bourgeois press is using this event to hammer against the monarchy. So, this book was read by Géricault. He becomes really fascinated with this event. He's preparing in his mind to execute a painting that will be in the Salon that opens in August 1819, and he decides he wants to paint the raft of the Medusa. It's a very dramatic story. So what does he do? His preparations to do the painting are fascinating. First of all, he finds the two men who wrote the book, a man named Alexandre Coriard and another named Henri Savigny. Coriard was an engineer on his way to Senegal to help set up the colony. Savigny was a naval surgeon. They were among the most educated survivors and therefore in a position to write a book. So Géricault finds them and he talks to them and he interviews them and he wants every detail about what happened on that raft. And then he finds a third survivor, a very important man by the name of Lavillette. Now this man was a soldier and a sailor. He was not an elite of any kind, but he was an experienced survivor. He was one of the carpenters who helped to build the raft. So Géricault says, build me a model of the raft so I will know exactly what it looks like. And he did. He built the raft. But Géricault didn't stop there. He wanted to know what this mass death looked like. So he went to the morgue and he got body parts. He wanted to know what did the skin of someone who had drowned look like. He brought these body parts back to the studio as he's executing his painting, and we know from his friends who were in the studio that it smelled terrible. The stench of these body parts was truly awful. But Géricault was determined to make this as realistic as possible. This was his plan. So he completes the painting, he enters it in the Salon in 1819, and it causes an uproar. First of all, because it's quite a political statement against the monarchy. But what's really fascinating is that if you look at the responses to the painting, some people liked it, probably more disliked it, but the critics, whether they were royalist or Republican, or whether they were conservative or liberal, they all basically said the same thing. They looked at this painting, they thought that it violated the aesthetic conventions of the day, but it also violated the narrative conventions, the story the painting is telling. And so the critics all say, look at this confused jumble of bodies. Where is the hero in this story? Jericho's message, there's no hero. There's no individual hero. The critics ask, where is the order and proper hierarchy in this situation? Jericho says, there's no order, there's no hierarchy. A couple of critics said, you look at these people, you can't even tell what nation they belong to. Jericho says, that's right, you can't. That's by design. So what Jericho is doing, I think, in this very powerful painting, is reflecting a fundamental truth of life at sea. The sea, and especially catastrophe at sea, levels all distinctions. It levels distinctions of class. It levels distinctions of race. It levels everything, and everyone is kind of thrown in together, struggling for survival. No heroes. If there's a hero, the hero is collective. It's this mass of people projecting energy upward and outward to save themselves. Now, another major point. If you read the book produced by Coriard and Savigny and then compare it to this painting, you will see that this painting has a much more radical vision of humanity, even though it's desperate. Because Coriard and Savigny were among the more privileged members of this expedition. They spoke about the soldiers and sailors on board the raft, and they called them, I quote, the scum of all countries. Does anybody know the French word for that, scum? I don't want this to be lost. The lowest of the low. Coriard and Savigny also expressed a great deal of racial prejudice against the black members of the crew, but also against the Senegalese. They were French nationalists. They were, in fact, imperialists. They wanted that colony of Senegal to come back, but Jericho says no. He says, I am leveling all of that. And that, I think, is a really important part of his vision. Because this is the way things worked at sea. Now, is there a French phrase for the term motley crew, Yevon? Say it again. Bigarre? The truth of the sea is that sailors of all nations had inhabited European sailing ships from the very beginning. The voyages of Columbus and Magellan had European and Greek and African, and they were always this multi-ethnic mass of humanity, and that is what Jericho painted. This was a very radical thing to have done, because another question the critics asked is, where is France in all this? Well, one person had an answer. One person said, this man here, staring blankly out into the bloody wake of the raft, that's France. And you'll notice that France is not even part of the upward trajectory of energy that is going to save the day. Now, I would ask you to pay special attention to what Jericho did with the African faces on the raft. Now, we know for a fact that there was one African sailor among the 15 who survived. His name was Jean Charles. He was one of the five who died very soon after the vessel was recovered. But notice Jericho puts several Africans on board the raft. You can see one at the upper, the very top, just below that cable, that's an African man. Here's an African man who is dead. It's kind of hard to tell about this man with the blue headband. he might be mixed race. And then there's another man sitting underneath the mask. He's in the dark, you can't tell, but it looks like he might be African as well. And then, of course, there is a man of color at the very peak. If there's a hero, that's the person. Now, we don't know who that is, but I have a hypothesis. I think that man is the soldier, sailor, worker named La Villette. Because, in fact, Jericho did a portrait of someone who was labeled only as Carpenter of the Medusa. He is a dark-skinned man, and the skin is almost identical to the man who's on the top of the vessel. So he's actually making a statement. He's making a statement about the place of race and slavery in French colonial history. This is one of the things that upset all the critics. And I think this is actually one of the things that makes this painting so perfect for the series that Françoise has designed. Now, the aftermath of the painting. Governor Schmaltz is delivered to Senegal, and guess what happens? The slave trade resumes. Coriard, who himself became quite a committed abolitionist, petitioned the French government to say, you must investigate what's going on in Senegal. This man has started the slave trade again. For a long time, this was an allegation, but now, because of data gathered for the African slave trade database, we actually have statistics to show that there was an upward spike of the slave trade out of Senegal as soon as this colony was reestablished. Okay, now, Jericho himself continues to be very interested in this subject. In 1819, after the Great Salon, he takes the painting to England and he exhibits it there. And while there, he actually makes contact with English abolitionists. Very significant. When he comes back in 1823, 1824, really near the end of his life, he does a sketch for what is going to be his next great painting, an epic painting like this. And guess what's the title of that painting? I'm sure some of you know. It's called The African Slave Trade. Now, I'll just point out a couple of details before concluding. You might be interested to know that among the people who came to the studio to help with the painting and to pose for a part is none other than Eugène Delacroix. And folks, that is him. That's the other famous romantic artist. Coriard is in the painting. He's the man who's raising his left hand. You see him at the back? He's the man who helped to write the book. This is technically inaccurate because according to the narrative of the voyage, Coriard was so weak that he could not stand when the raft was finally recovered. So, the other thing I'll point out, in learning how the raft was made, what La Villette told Jericho and showed him in the model was that a ship's mast, such as you have right here, was used to construct the raft in one direction, and ship's spars, you know, the arms on which sails hang, are the cross hatches, and you can actually see here's the beveled area that would attach to the mast. So these are some of the things that he did, he learned in order to get the details right. So I think in the end, there was one man in 1819 who understood this painting, a man named Auguste Jarre. He wrote, this painting, he liked the painting very much. He understood what the painting was doing in terms of depicting sailors at life at sea, And moreover, he understood that the painting had an abolitionist undertone. Jal wrote, "This painting is about, quote, the advancement of the Negro." Now, what I find especially fascinating about that, the reason why Jal understood, Jal had been a sailor. He had been a midshipman in the French Navy, and he would go on to become the founding father of French maritime history and French maritime archaeology. But he understood what Jericho understood about this leveling power of the sea. And finally, I would just ask you to use your imagination. If Jericho's tragically short life had not ended at age 32, we would have, alongside this great painting, another one right here called The African Slave Trade. Thank you very much.